Welcome to our program. I'm Richard Ugin. Thank you very much for joining us as we are set to talk once again. It's really a pleasure to have Eric Weimer on our program. And if you do not recall who he is, Eric is the first blind man to ever scale Mount Everest. And he did that back in May of 2001. And Eric, it is good to have you on the program this morning.
Thank you.
You are actually on a journey, as it were, a quest to accomplish something that only a few, very few people have done, and that is to scale the seven highest peaks on the planet. And you are in the process of completing that process. I guess, what, you're about one or two peaks shy?
Yeah, I finished my sixth last week, and it's a quest to climb the highest peak in each of the seven continents, so I've been all around the world. In 95, I started with Mount McKinley in North America. In 96 and 7, I was on Aconcagua, the tallest in South America, and climbed Kilimanjaro in Africa, and Mount Vincent in Antarctica, and Mount Everest, Asia, and obviously the tallest peak in the world. And then last week, we climbed Mount Elbrus, which is the tallest peak in Europe. It's located in Russia, big snowy mountain. And And then in a couple months, we're going to head off to the tallest peak in what's called Australasia, which is it's a big island, and half of it is a place called Irianjaya or Papua. And there's a big rock face in the jungle that we're going to climb, and that's the seventh summit. It's called Karstens Pyramid.
And, of course, I suppose doesn't even need to be asked. On the one hand, why climb these mountains? And some would answer, well, because they're there, the old cliche. But I know that you have a lot of people who are backing you, and obviously the challenges in life, it's one of the things I know that we all are seeking out to, I guess, keep us motivated, keep us moving forward in our lives. And some of us have them thrust upon us, and some of us thrust them upon ourselves. And it's kind of what you're doing in your life as far as, I guess, keeping yourself motivated. I know that that's not actually the reason why you're doing this, but I know, obviously, that you are enjoying it immensely.
Yeah, I mean, when I went blind, I went at 13. I went through a few years where it was probably sort of frustration bubbling under the surface, and I really wanted to, you know, my brothers were athletes and my dad is an athlete, and my friends were athletes and they were doing exciting things, and everyone had, lots of people around me seemed to have a passion. And I wanted to sort of find my niche, and I wanted to have adventure in my life. I wanted to breathe in as much joy as I could in my life. I didn't want to just sort of be stuck sitting on the sidelines watching life pass me by. And so I turned to rock climbing, and it was a group of kids, blind kids, who were taking rock climbing. And it was just sort of, in a sense, to help us overcome fears or take some calculated risks. And I loved it. I mean, I actually love the sport. I found I could feel my way up the rock face. I could use my hands and feet as my eyes, and I could feel my way up this rock face and kind of unravel solve this puzzle in my mind of how to get from point A to point B. And it's all about using your body and your leverage and your angles of your body. So I just loved it. It was just such an exciting challenge. And so it just brought me to all sorts of other mountains, bigger and bigger mountains as I got more experienced. And at one point I said, I want to try a really big mountain. And I went out and climbed Mount McKinley, and it was the hardest thing I'd ever done. But I just loved it, and it taught me that we really can, you know, push ourselves well beyond what we ever thought we could. And thing I like about climbing is the aspect of it's just so tremendously beautiful out there. I mean, whether you can see it or not, there's tremendous beauty. It's all around. You can hear it. You can hear the sky, actually, when you listen for it. You can, all the different kinds of snow under your feet and all the different kinds of ice that you feel. It's amazing. And then the third thing I really like is the team. The nature and the outdoors, the mountains, they're beautiful places, but they're a bit austere. And so when you have really good friends that are surrounding you, it's it really warms the scene up enough that, you know, you feel like, you know, you're not really, you're part of nature, but yet you're also part of, you know, the human race, and sort of as humans, you're kind of coming together to kind of make yourselves more powerful, and and that's what you kind of need to do to stand on top of mountains. You help each other get to the top, and it's a really good feeling of friendship when you get up there. I've had all sorts of good friends on the mountain and off the mountain. Our major sponsor of these Seven Summits climbs is Allegra Allergy Medication, and I have allergies, and as I'm approaching the climbs, there's always flowers and trees and grass all around, and so I take Allegra, and they've been a tremendous help to me and a big part of the climbs themselves. So friends on and off the mountain.
Well, you've done a lot of other things as well besides climb mountains. You've also been a middle school teacher and a wrestling coach. And as I kind of found the terminology probably about 10 or 15, maybe 20 years ago, I used to refer to any condition that might be considered or labeled as a handicap, as a perceived limitation. And in your case, the blindness that you have is just that. It's a perceived. You do not perceive it. In essence, it's your perception is it's not going to limit me from accomplishing and doing the things that I want to do in my life.
Yeah, I mean, disabilities are an interesting thing. They're going to evolve, I mean, as we kind of progress through society, as we progress through time, I mean, because, you know, with technology and with people's sort of attitudes, right attitudes of sighted people and blind people, or the able-bodied community and the disabled community, you know, yeah, it's going to be sort of a fuzzy line. You know, what is the word disabled even mean anymore?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there are some physical things I can't do. I can't drive a car.
Right.
You know, but those things may just sort of fall by the wayside eventually.
You know, as
technology overcomes those things. But I guess that, yeah, that is a sort of one of the good messages of some of these climbs is that it sort of does, you know, I think the word blind and the word climber or the word Everest especially, it's a disconnect in people's minds. I mean, people don't really get it, you know, they don't really, the average person wouldn't connect those two things. And so I think when a blind person gets to the top of all these mountains, and I mean, and these are difficult, very difficult mountains, I think it does sort of take people's perceptions about what's possible and what's not, and it sort of shatters them into many pieces. And when you have to rebuild those perceptions, I think what happens is your perceptions of what's possible and what's not just becomes bigger. You know, it expands, and I think that's good. You know, because as humans, I think we judge a little too much. You know, it's good to sort of be forced to keep an open mind.
Indeed.
That creates more opportunity for everyone.
Yes. And, of course, people all over the country in the United States, as well as around the world, are facing, as we've talked in the beginning here, about all of these challenges that just life just throws at you sometimes. And I know that, I'm pretty sure that you do a lot of speaking when you're not climbing to groups and individuals and so forth. Do you ever wonder... Or do you ever get the comment from people something along the lines of, when you're climbing, when are they going to put handrails, you know, on these climbs, on these mountains, so that it makes it easier for me, in terms of putting those kinds of handrails as a metaphor into our lives? I mean, they just don't exist, and yet people want them so desperately to make it, quote unquote, easier for them to get through life.
I think so. You know, life is exciting and challenging and it's all those things. I mean, but it's not meant to necessarily be easy,
mm-hmm.
You know. And I think we just have to understand that it's the big exciting things in life aren't easy, you know. And you know, as an outdoors person, yeah, I tend to think that we've become a little bit too soft, maybe as a society. I think there are exciting challenges out there, and as people, we need to rise to the occasion rather than having sort of the world sort of change for our own use, you know. I think we have to do the opposite. As a blind person, I've figured out techniques and strategies that enable me to succeed in the outdoors in that hostile environment that doesn't really care too much about human beings.
for many.
I would hate to, you know, adapt the environment to just to fit me.
And I certainly can agree with that, especially because of the things that have happened in my own life. Some of the things that you have available, number one, to our listeners are our website, which is www. And it's also the title of your book, touchthetop.com. Actually, the title of the book is Touch the Top of the World, but touchthetop.com is your website. And if people want to go there and check out not only your book, but also some of the photographs of some of your climbs, as well as photographs within the book, too, showing you going through the process of climbing, learning, and succeeding at, obviously, reaching the peak of Everest. I also recall last year when we talked about your climb to the summit of Everest, that you were actually pushing the clock, as it were, because you're only allowed to climb that mountain during certain times of the year, and there is a cutoff point near the end of May, I believe it is, due to weather changes.
Yeah, all these peaks have sort of windows of opportunity, yeah, in terms of when the weather's the best. Everest, obviously, is always better climbed in the spring. In the fall, it's been climbed from time to time. But the weather's really windy and cold. Not too many people do that. So in May, you get these little respites that of good weather, between the high winds of the winter and the monsoon spring snows of the summer. And you have to kind of stand on top during those little respites, those little moments of high pressure where there's not a lot of wind. Usually Everest in the winter, all through the winter, it's in the jet stream, so it's just hammering 100, 200 mile an hour winds up there, and it's dumping snow like crazy in the summer. So every now and then the mountain will give you a little break, and everyone positions themselves on the mountain to get ready for those little breaks. And so you have a lot of people heading to the summit on the same day, because you only get a few days a year to, you know, that are quiet up there. And that's what we were waiting for, waiting and waiting through May. They do ask you to be off the mountain. Your permit only goes to the last day of May, because as the spring snows, you know, late spring snows come in to Everest, it also is getting warmer, and a lot of the crevasses down low are breaking up, and seracs, these big ice walls, are collapsing all over the trail. So you got to be off. You really should be off the mountain in terms of safety. So, but we found our, we waited and waited. The 23rd of May, we got the idea on the internet that there was going to be a little bit of high pressure, so we pushed up through the ice fall, which is this really broken up terrible section of the mountain below the glacier. Went to camp 1, climbed up to camp 2, went to camp 3, went to camp 4. The weather seemed to be holding on us, and so we were able to summit May 25th, which only gave us, you know, 4 or 5 days to spare.
Did you ever find yourself as you make these climbs asking yourself, what am I doing up here? Because the challenge was really pushing you to the limit where, gee, I wish they would just come with a helicopter, pull me off this mountain. I won't be doing this again. kind of sensation.
Yeah, you definitely feel like that a lot. You know, your mind, hard things, you know, your mind sort of wants the easy way out. You know, it's just sort of a natural thing. You know, you say, what am I doing here? You question yourself quite a bit, and you think, man, I don't know if I'm really cut out for this lifestyle. It's really way too hard for me. You know, that's usually towards the end of the day when you're struggling into camp, and you feel like you're suffocating, and you have a huge pack on, and yeah, that's just sort of part of the game. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's part of the equation. You know, it's not all going to be fun. Overall, it's an incredible experience, but it's not, you know, only small parts of it are fun.
and I'm curious, too, as to whether mountain climbing for you is the biggest challenge in your life, or if you have had other things happen, you're going, gee, you know, I thought mountain climbing was tough, but gee, this is really tough. Anything that actually maybe outclasses by virtue of challenge for you in your life?
Well, you know, mountain climbing is definitely challenging. I think being a parent sometimes is challenging. I have a beautiful daughter named Emma, but again, the rewards are incredible. You know, a lot of people don't know that I do have seasonal allergies, and that's why I've been connected with Allegra through the years, and that's been a great relationship. So yeah, there are plenty of other challenges out there that people don't know about me. Everyone has challenges, and whether you're quote unquote disabled or not, I think everyone has challenges that they feel, you know, this holds me back or that holds me back. And that's why I think these climbs in that way are really positive for folks.
Do you ever consider the possibility, once you have achieved the seventh summit and that incredible feat, climbing Everest, from my perspective, we have a couple of small little hills that a lot of people hike here in the Valley of the Sun that are challenging in and of themselves. But the reverse or the converse, if you will, of climbing the mountains would be going down into some of the caverns and caves and so forth on the planet.
No, I don't know about that. My wife might be upset with me if I continue to find challenges that are life, you know, that are risky to life and limb. I gotta sort of be careful, but I do see myself as a mountain climber and as an outdoorsman, and so there are so many mountains out there. I think after the seven summits are finished, there's this big 2,000 foot rock face in Canada called Lotus Flower Tower. It's part of a chain called the Circa of the Untouchables. It's an incredible rock face. I'd love to go lead the whole thing. There's so many mountains out there to keep me busy. I don't have any trouble finding new challenges. And as I said, you know, I mean, I have a great family. So after, you know, climbing is, I can't climb at a top level anymore. I haven't lost anything. You know, I have a great family and a great life and good friends. So
In terms of the future, obviously, one day you will stop climbing, as you're saying, and you do have a lot going on, but and you'll continue, I'm sure, speaking with groups and working with the various companies, corporations, organizations, and so forth. Is there a particular philosophy or concept, idea, etc.? I'm trying to think of other words to describe this, that you live by. I mean, obviously, we already know, as we've talked with you and you've shared with us here in this program about, you know, taking on challenges, and it's what makes us, you know, move forward and grow and live and so forth. But is there a particular philosophy that you have sort of adopted into your life that has fostered this desire to take on these challenges?
You know, honestly, I'm sort of a pragmatist, and so I come from a family where people, you know, whatever you believe, whether it's right or wrong, you become a doer. And I think in the, you know, 2002, you know, lots of people talk, and talking is wonderful because that's where a lot of ideas come from. But more importantly, I think we best are judged, and I think we, the best results come from just actions, you know, to be a doer. There's a guy I know in Colorado. He's a partial quadriplegic. His name's Steve Ackerman, and he designs hand cycles, and he was the first quadriplegic to pedal around the world with his arms, with this hand cycle. Just absolutely amazing. You know, it took him months and months, and through, you know, 18 countries, I think. He got back to the United States, and there was a group of people gathered around him that were interested in, at the end of his journey, to hear what he had to say. And he said, the greatest word in the English language is the word encourage. It's, you know, to give people the courage to do great things by our own example of doing great things. And I thought, that's super powerful. That's so incredible, because that's what it is. I mean, you give people... You know, you go out and do exciting things, and that gives people the courage to go out and do, you know, to live their lives the way they want to. And it's like the, you know, Olympics last summer. You know, you're passing this flame on from person to person, from life to life, and it gives people leadership, and it gives people courage. You know, and that's I think that's what we need to do as human beings, and maybe not talk as much.
Yeah, as you're sharing that story, and I think even of as you're thinking of your climbs and so forth, the one movie that pops into my mind and the scene was from the movie Forrest Gump, where he's running and running and running and running, and everybody is just so, I mean, they're following him and they're so excited and this is wonderful, and we're running across the country, and suddenly he stops and says, I'm going to go home now.
Right.
And leaves them out there. And and it's a wonderful thing for somebody to encourage you to go out and do things, but you better be going out there and doing them more because you want to do them. It's wonderful you have this, because this other individual eventually is going to stop.
Exactly. That's a great message.
And so when people go to your website, what aside from obviously your book and biography and so forth, what are some of the other things we might be able to find out about you, about your organizations and that you're involved with and so forth?
Well, I'm also involved in the National Federation of the Blind. You'll learn about them. They've also been a sponsor of the Seven Summits Climbs. They're a blindness organization that are really empowering. It's a lot of blind people sort of empowering other blind people. And they're located in Baltimore, and I work with them quite a bit. And you'll see a lot of great photos and a lot of information. And there's along with my book, Touch the Top of the World, there's a curriculum guide for schools. So it's just a lot of informational things. Also from there, you can link to another website, which is connected with the Seven Summits. It's sevensummitsexpedition.com. And you can learn about our Elbrus climb. Allegra made this great website with some great photos from Elbrus. And one of the things about Elbrus that was unique, and I just got home a week ago, we summited on June 13th, was we climbed Elbrus and then skied down it. And I, as a blind skier, I ski with a sighted friend. My friend's name is Eric Alexander, and we got to the summit and skied down most of the way, about almost 10,000 feet down to the base of the mountain. It was just absolutely incredible.
How long did that take to come down?
2 days to come down. We skied about 5,000 feet the first day and another 7,000 feet the next day.
Wow. And how long did it take you to ascend?
To go up a week.
I bet
we just had a great time.
I was going to say, you had more fun coming down than going up.
It is fun going down. It's a little scary sometimes because it's such a windy mountain that it was a lot of ice at the top, and then it snowed, and so there was lots of powder over ice, and then the wind creates these waves in the ice called sastrugi, which is like really wave, like actually looks like waves in the ice, and so you're skiing up and over these waves, you know, so it's not like beautiful, nice turns, you know, you're sort of trying to survive up there. You're getting really thrown around and beat up. And at altitude, you know, you're skiing, do like four turns, and you just hang your head and feel a little nauseated and have to breathe a whole bunch. But as I got down probably below 16,000 feet, the skiing actually turned into sort of more pretty skiing. And there, you know, it's a little less windy down there, and it was more powder. So we were just flying down this mountain, having the best time of our lives. And I always wanted to ski off one of the Seven Summits. So, after Elbrus, we started talking amongst our team, and we thought we might try to paraglide off the Seventh Summit. We'll see. I don't know if that's going to happen or not. My wife might nix that idea, but it's fun to think about.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's something that I know that many of us would love to think about doing. I would venture that most of us probably would not be able to muster up quite enough courage to say, you know, yeah, I'm gonna follow Eric, and I'm gonna climb these things. What kind of training, and how long do you need to train for these seven summit climbs?
Well, training, you know, is a lot of climbing. So as you're climbing, you're getting more experienced, and you're learning about the mountains. You're learning about avalanche conditions and about knots and about how to be efficient on rock faces and ice faces and things like that. So training is mental and physical, and the mental part takes years and years. You know, you're accumulating knowledge that, you know, one of those little bits of knowledge may save your life down the road. So, yeah, I mean, experience level is very important, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then physical training, I mean, takes a good 6 months to get into physical shape. And, you know, I just put a big pack on and hump my way up mountains in the winter and during good snowstorms where, you know, it's really terrible weather out, you know, learn to suffer a little bit. I just work out on a step mill, on a Stairmaster. I go to the rock gym. I go to the tallest building in Denver, and I put a big pack on, and I run up the stairs. It's a 51-floor building. Mm. So I just do a lot of training at home, and just anything and everything, lots of cross-training, lots of, you know, anything to increase your VO2 max.
Yeah.
You know, to increase your lungs' capacity to intake oxygen. And it's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of suffering. You know, it's a lot of running up mountains in the snow, and like, you know, 2 feet of snow, and you feel like you're going to throw up, and
you just have to push forward.
That's what you do to get in shape for high altitude peaks.
Now, when you are climbing peaks such as Everest, you have to take with you, on the one hand, a lot of gear, but by the same token, you've got to really pare it down, if you will, to the bare essentials. And one of those bare essentials are tanks of air at certain levels. My understanding is that you have to have some assistance there. You've got to have some oxygen, because you don't have the same mixture that we have down here at, shall we say, ground level.
Yeah, there are some people that have climbed Everest without any bottled oxygen. I don't know how many. I'd like to research that. I'd say it's probably maybe 20 people or mm-hmm. less still. But the average good athlete or mountain climber has to use bottled oxygen above 25,000 feet, let's say, because there's just not enough oxygen up there to one, enough to really breathe, but even more important than that, to keep your body warm. You know, your body, your cells use oxygen to stay warm. So there's just not enough oxygen to maintain your core body temperature. So yeah, people go on bottled oxygen. It gives them a little bit more energy and a little more reserves and keeps them warmer. At the top of Mount Everest, there's only a third less oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. There's one third the oxygen that there is at sea level.
Okay.
That's how to phrase it. And so, but there's also such little pressure that there's only one third of the pressure when you breathe driving the oxygen into your lungs. So, you know, it's like, I don't know how to describe it. It's like putting a plastic bag over your head and then running a marathon, you know?
Yeah.
It's an uncomfortable feeling. You have to really, you know, just keep yourself calm and relax and not panic, because you can really kind of get panicky feeling. And then you also sort of get this lethargic feeling where you're not really thinking. It's like you're sleepwalking almost, you know. It's very hard to make decisions. It's hard to not make decisions, but to make good decisions, you know. Sometimes your decision is just, I'm going to sit down for a while, and that's a bad thing.
Yeah. We are obviously limited on time because you have other interviews and things and challenges and what have you to go off to, but I'm curious, as we wrap up, every moment as you're climbing these mountains, and maybe even in your training for that matter, you are putting your life and limb at risk. Have there been moments, you know, where you're walking on that razor's edge, where you felt as though this is it? I'm going over the edge to the other side, so to speak.
Well, you know, climbing is, there are calculated risks involved, obviously. I mean, that's obvious, but it's not all about risk. I mean, you know, most of the time when you're climbing, you're just out having fun. You know, and if you know what you're doing, if you have the right skills, if you're in shape, if you're surrounded by the right people, you really do minimize that risk to the point that it just becomes a calculated risk. You know, and there's only a few times in my climbing career that I've really laid it on the line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on a hard rock climb now and then, you know, if I'm leading, you know, I'll lay it out a little bit, you know, meaning sometimes you're putting protection into the rock as you're climbing up. And, you know, if you're 10 feet above your last piece of protection, if you fall, you know, you're going to fall like 30 feet. And so I've done that. I do it from time to time. On Everest, on summit day, when I reach the south summit, 28,800 feet, And at that point, you climb down over the backside of the south summit, and you you cross this little knife-edge ridge with a 12,000-foot drop on the right, and there's an 8,000-foot drop on the left, and it's about the width of a picnic table. You're walking on these, like, slopey rocks with your crampons. And it's, you know, I guess you'd say you're putting it out there at that point. But I try to make those moments few and far between because, as I said, climbing for me isn't about assuming a great amount of risk. It's more about, you know, celebrating what you can do.
Right. I did learn one very valuable lesson, and that is when I was climbing and reached to one of the peaks here in the valley, I was trying to take my pack off standing on a place, and I almost fell backwards.
You can throw yourself off. Yeah. You can lose your balance doing that. People do that all the time.
And the first thing that went through my mind was something that somebody told me not more than a few days earlier. If you ever start to do something like that, crouch and get your center of gravity back, which is exactly what I did, or I would have been going head over heels down the hill.
Right.
So that was a scary moment for me. And it's just something that is real important. It sounds to me, though, like you have mastered your center of gravity and have managed to accomplish some awesome, awesome things. And we want to thank you very much for taking time to share with us about your experiences. And folks, you can find out more about Eric by going to the website touchthetop.com, www.touchthetop.com. Find out about Eric, his the other websites that are linked to his, and also pick up a copy of Touch the Top of the World. It's a blind man's journey to climb farther than the eye can see, which is a great line, and we wish you much success.
Thanks.
and safety in your future endeavors, our best to you and your family. And again, thank you very much for joining us on the program.
My pleasure. Hey, and the book is also in Braille and on tape as well.
And that's
so for anyone who's blind who's interested in reading it. Thanks a lot. I had a great time.
Thank you very much, Eric.
All right.
I'm Richard Dugan, and you've been listening to Sun Talk.